Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Most pastors, priests, and rabbis will tell you that prayer is good for your spiritual health, but can prayer actually be beneficial to your physical health? Does having a closer connection with God enhance the process of healing during bouts of illness? Do people who attend church regularly lead more healthy lives? Today on Research and Religion, we are going to explore these questions with one of the leading scholars in the somewhat new and growing field of religion and health, Jeff Levin. Professor Levin is an epidemiologist by training, holds a distinguished chair at Baylor University, where he is the University Professor of Epidemiology and Population Health, Professor of Medical Humanities, and also the Director of the Program on Religion and Population Health at the Institute for Studies of Religion, the host of this podcast. Jeff has authored numerous books and articles on the connection between religion and health, including God, Faith, and Health, and the recently released Divine Love, Perspectives from the World's Religious Traditions. He's also a big fan of Merle Haggard and classic country music, and I think that's a pretty cool thing. So, Jeff, welcome to Research on Religion.
Hi, Tony. It's great to be here. And now you've outed me as a Merle Haggard and George Jones fan.
I don't know what to say. Yeah, well, I think that's pretty cool. You know, being down in Waco, you gotta have that to, you know, have your props, I guess.
So. Absolutely.
All right, let me cut to the chase here, and I'm sure a lot of people are interested in the question I'm going to start off with here. I'm at church yesterday, and the pastor is giving a sermon on resisting the physical temptations of the world. And then when we walk out into the lobby following the service, there's the church youth group there selling donuts to finance their next mission trip. And I'm like, oh, this is a test, right? So my first reaction, reflecting on the message of resisting temptations that we just heard, was to denounce the kids as Satan spawn and tip over their tables. But for those of you who know me, I'm a little bit, you know, I'd say fluffy. Donuts are my kryptonite, and with three kids yelling in my ear to buy them the ones with the chocolate icing and sprinkles so as they can save the children of the world from starving, how could I resist? So, you know, out comes the wallet. Myself, I dug into an apple fritter for which of those of you might not know what an apple fritter is. It has little to do with apples and everything to do with about 40 grams of deep fried sugar and lard, kind of best described as the black hole of calories in the food world. So my question for you is, how many Hail Marys do I have to do to make this delectable pastry truly guilt-free?
Well, Tony, that's a question that nobody has ever posed to me before, and I don't think there's ever been any NIH-funded research on the topic, but how many Hail Marys to make that pastry guilt-free? I don't know.
I'll ask for an answer. I guess I'm more than happy to volunteer as in a clinical trial, and you know, you can give me the donuts. Avoid the placebos.
That reminds me of a funny story of my own. Years ago, I was doing some research on I'd be called esoteric religion, and met somebody who actually had been a psychic trance channel. How's that for something unusual?
Wow.
Brought forth a message about donuts, that they were spiritual poison unfit for a dog. I don't know how.
Really?
I remembered that, what neurons that story was stored in. But that's my lone anecdote about donuts. I like them too, and I'm a little fluffy too, I guess.
All right. Unfit for a dog. It's a good thing that I'm not a dog then. So I'll be out on those donuts then. On a more serious note here, though, explain to us how you, as a professor of epidemiology, came to study the connection between religion and health. I couldn't imagine that this was, you know, a topic that, when you began your career, was widely spread. Let's study religion and health.
No, absolutely not. And my origins in this field is kind of a funny story. I was a very young graduate student at the University of North Carolina, the School of Public Health, and this was, 1982, almost 30 years ago. And I was in a class with a very famous epidemiologist by the name of Dr. Bert Kaplan, and it was a class on social and cultural factors in health, behavioral factors, things like stress and type A behavior, those sorts of things that influence health. And one of the articles we had to read in the course pack was a study that had been done that had correlated the frequency of attendance at church services with rates of mortality in, I think, in Baltimore, Maryland. This was a study that had been conducted by the Department of Epidemiology at Johns Hopkins University. So this was not, you know, fringe stuff. This was a very serious epidemiologic study of mortality rates. And for some reason, amongst all the hundreds of questions that had been asked in the survey, you know, blood pressure and family history and income and, you know, all the myriad things that, that we epidemiologists ask about, for some unusual reason, the researchers had decided to ask people how often they went to church. And I thought this was the craziest thing I ever saw in my life. And they got some interesting results, and they ended up spinning off a paper and publishing it in the Journal of Chronic Diseases, a very prominent journal at the time.
Do you remember what the results of that paper were?
Yeah. Very strange. They found that people who attended church less than once a month compared to people who attended church more than once a month or more, actually had, on the average, had higher mortality rates over a five-year period due to cancer and heart disease and a bunch of other stuff. And this was all, you know, this was a very fine, nicely done epidemiologic study. The, you know, everything was done spick and span, passed peer review. And so I read this in the course pack, and I just thought this was the nuttiest thing I ever saw, but it was, the study was bulletproof. So I went to Dr. Kaplan, and I said, you know what? I wonder, do you know if there's other studies like this out there? I thought we needed to write a term paper for the class. I thought this should be my topic. Why not? I actually had a my undergraduate degree from Duke University was in religious studies. So I thought, well, it's a natural. I'll write a paper on this. And so I went out to the library and over the semester, and I found about 12, 15 studies similar to this. And I thought this was really fascinating. So I wrote it up, wrote a term paper, presented it to the class, and that was kind of the end of it, except that Dr. Kaplan said, you know, Jeff, it's interesting stuff. Why don't you write this up as an article to submit to one of the medical journals? And I was, like I said, I was about 22, 23, and this was just, it blew my mind. So I thought, well, you know what, this is a great idea. And so I thought, well, I'll go to the library, and I'll look around, and I'll see if, you know, I'll search Medline. There was no PubMed back then. You actually had to search the old volumes of Index Medicus and just see if there's other studies out there. Because I thought, you know, it'd be kind of embarrassing to write a literature review paper and say there were 12 or 13 or 14 studies, and really there had been 20 or 25 done. So I was kind of wanted to be comprehensive. So I went to the library and began hunting down studies in the medical literature or the biomedical or epidemiologic literature in which people had asked questions about religion or religious beliefs or religious practices, and then done some statistical analysis to look at it in relation to health or disease or so on. And this kind of set me off on a wild goose chase that ended up, Tony, consuming my nights and weekends for most of the next 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
And by then I was a doctoral student at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston, studying entirely different subjects than this, but was still going to the library every evening and hunting down these studies. I kept finding more and more. And
so this
by the
was
time I was done, like I say, about 4 or 5 years later, I'd found over 200 of these suckers.
Wow.
And studies of heart disease and cancer and gastrointestinal disorders and psychiatric disorders and you name it, and the mortality rates. And so I wrote this all up with a colleague in a literature review article and published it in a journal. And this was 23, 24 years ago. So I actually trained as a reproductive epidemiologist, perinatal epidemiologist. My training was in things like low birth weight and infant mortality. So this was kind of a... this was just something I did on the side, and I had no idea this was going to turn into a career, or that that my little wild goose chase was going to create a field. This was the farthest thing from my mind. I thought at the time this was just the craziest thing I'd ever seen, and my curiosity as a scientist was very simple. It was, gosh, you know, are there other studies like this? Have other people looked at this? You know, what are the findings? What, how can we make sense of this? So, I mean, I came at it strictly as a very left-brain scientist, mm-hmm. trying to figure out this strange riddle and to try to gather all the information that's been published. So that's really how I got into it.
That's kind of neat. That's an interesting story. I think very relevant for any graduate students or future graduate students listening to us, is that you follow your passion.
I tell grad students all the time, and medical students, that, you know, if you have a curiosity, if you have an interest, pursue it. You don't know what will come of it.
Right.
You know, you can uncover information that can be vitally important and that can change the course of your field. And don't let anybody discourage you.
Let's talk about that. People discouraging you. It's when you think about medical studies, you think about epidemiology, biology, and such. Normally, people do not put religion in connection with this.
That's an understatement.
That, you know, doctors, they're the white lab coats, stethoscopes. They put all that religion stuff aside in that. Did you face any flack early on from people saying, "Oh, this is crazy, Jeff. Why are you doing this? You're going to ruin your career."
Oh, absolutely, explicitly in those words. When I was in Texas, so this was in the mid '80s, and I was a young grad student in his 20s, and I, you know, all the professors knew I was, you know, wasting my time going to the library looking up all these weird studies when I had other more important things to do. And actually had one professor was out of our program. I won't mention his name. He's retired now. But he even took me aside one day, called me into his office, and kind of put his arm around my shoulder. And he said, "Jeff," and it was like that scene. I always tell the story. It was like that scene in The Graduate where they took Dustin Hoffman aside, and he said, "I got one word for you, boy, plastic."
Yeah.
And so the professor, he's very nice. He took me aside, and he said, "Jeff, you know, you're doing all this weird stuff, religion. People are starting to talk." And then he uttered the words, "Jeff, you need a disease." And, but as any reputable biomedical scientist or epidemiologist, I needed a disease. I needed heart disease or cancer or diabetes. And so I ended up, that led me to begin studying perinatal outcomes, because, you know, I discovered that in the medical model, the day pregnancy apparently counted as a disease. And so that was a very mm-hmm. reputable thing for me to study. So, I mean, there was certainly resistance within my training. And then in the early years of starting to publish, I started to publish papers on this topic in the mid-'80s. And, you know, for people in the audience that don't know how this works, you know, you write a paper, you submit it to a medical journal, and the article is then blindly reviewed, peer-reviewed by reviewers, and they make the recommendations back to the journal. And just, you know, had some really unusual experiences. The most unusual, very prominent journal in the epidemiology field, one of my early review articles in this field, the reviewers actually liked it and recommended that the paper be published. But the editor, in his cover letter back to me, and usually, just again for the audience, when, you know, usually you hear back from a journal, you get a little letter from the editor of the journal. It's usually just some boilerplate telling you, you know, either you're in or the paper's rejected or whatever. Well, this guy went on for about two pages, single space, very angry, rejecting the paper and telling me that not only was this paper unacceptable, but the subtitle of the paper had been "Toward an Epidemiology of Religion."
Hmm.
I think the title was something like, "Is the church attendance really related to health," or something like that.
Right.
So he was telling me that not only was the paper unacceptable, but the mere idea, the mere notion of religion being epidemiologically relevant was, and then the word he used was, execrable. And I had to look the word up.
And the definition is?
And I was under the impression that this was a scatological mm-hmm. term, not an eschatological term, but
right.
a scatological term. And years later, I was telling this story to a group of clergy in a pastoral care training program, and one of the people was a Catholic priest who was an expert in Latin, and he said, no, execrable isn't related to excretion, it's related to execration. And so I said, well, what does that mean? So he looked it up in the dictionary, and it said, worthy of being, let's see, what did it say, worthy of being abhorred, abominated, or something like that. And so I thought, well, okay, that's that pretty much says it. But I mean, I think there's there's really an interesting underlying message here, and that's to raise these sorts of issues in certain intellectual communities in a very left brain, mechanistic, biomedically focused world, to raise issues of psyche or spirit and so on is to challenge the heart of the worldview. And you will be, at least there was a time, you know, you'll be accused effectively of heresy or apostasy.
Right.
That's really what I went through. Now, you know, thankfully that's changed to a large extent. It's 25 years later. And the last I saw, there have been something like 3,000 of these studies published. And you know, there's electives in 100 medical schools on spirituality. And so, I mean, I can't say that these ideas have, you know, completely taken over the mainstream, but I think certainly most medical students or public health students or nursing students coming up now, they're at least familiar with the fact that there's a scientific literature on mind-body healing and spirituality and health and so on. So it's not the career ender that it might have been 3 decades ago.
Let me you talk about that one article that the cover letter came back from the journal. You know, apparently the reviewers liked this, and you know, you got some results that showed some statistical significance out there. How could the editor, you know, say, oh, this isn't worthy or it should be abhorred when you got results that are showing, I would assume that you did show some connection between church attendance or religious belief and some kind of positive or negative health outcome?
Well, it's a great question, Tony. How does the editor come to the conclusion there's nothing there? I've been thinking about this for 25 years. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I think that certain things are just, at the time, were just beyond the pale. I mean, the other thing is, editors are all powerful.
Right.
And I'm not telling this story out of sour grapes. Any of us in the academic world, we could paper our wall with papers, with letters of rejection from journals. That's no big deal. And I eventually published the paper in a very good pastoral care journal. I think just that certain ideas are just outside the pale. And, if you know, at the time, medicine, biomedicine, was wrestling with this kind of body-mind dualism issue. The whole idea of behavioral medicine and psychosomatic medicine and health psychology really was coming to the forefront in the 70s and the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And it really, you know, for biomedicine, it was the word that people used at the time, it was a paradigm shift. Mm-hmm. And here I am, one paradigm beyond that even,
right,
wanting to approach these issues. It was just, I think for some people, just too much too soon.
Yeah.
But thankfully, I really wasn't the only one. I discovered a few years later that there were others of us that had kind of discovered the same literature. And, you know, and the thing to remember, these reviews that I was writing in the mid-80s, these were literature reviews of existing research studies. This wasn't my studies or experiments,
right,
or lab work. This was just me surveying all this work that had been done, frankly, dating to the 1800s, to the 19th century.
Well, that's kind of interesting.
These were studies in every religious denomination, studies of men and women, every race and ethnicity, every nationality.
Mm-hmm.
These were prospective longitudinal studies. These were retrospective case control studies, cohort studies, every type of research. These were studies of heart disease, cancer, mortality rates, mental health, and so on. So this wasn't just a few papers in a certain area. This was all kinds of research, and throughout it, on the average, it seemed to be that higher levels of involvement in religion or faith seemed to result in lower rates or lower levels of what in epidemiology we call morbidity and mortality, sickness, mm-hmm, and rates of death. And on the average, I mean, that's very important. But so in a way, these studies were no different than any other type of research that's done in the epidemiologic field. It's just that the questions people were asked, instead of being about physical issues or biological issues or even mental or psychological issues, they were just asked about, you know, are you a member of a church? You go to church? You believe in God? What religion are you? And
right. That
information is just as reliably obtained and validly obtained as anything else that anyone could be asked in a survey.
Well, let me ask you this, being that I'm not all that familiar with epidemiology. I usually pass out when I drive by a hospital to begin with.
Well, me too.
the question of how do these questions get inserted into these studies. Now, it's interesting, you saw, you know, when you first started this, you found a handful of studies, a couple dozen studies, and then realized later that there were, you know, several hundred studies prior to the 80s on this stuff. How did the religion variable get put into these studies, and what does an epidemiology study look like? Who would come up with the idea of, let's ask about church attendance or religious belief?
Well, you know, why these questions were in these big studies decades ago, that I really, to this day, don't have a don't have a real good explanation. From my perspective, it's just serendipity.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, I mean, at the time, the way that we do research, you know, we apply for, we get a grant to collect data on a population, and there's usually a team of people that inserts into their data collection instrument, which is usually a survey, and whether the survey is implemented by an interviewer or it's self-administered, that depends on the study. But then a variety of questions are included, and some of these are well-known, validated scales or indices on certain concepts, and
right.
Others are just one-off questions. And generally, you assemble a team of scientists, and people tend to have their pet interests and pet things that they want to put in the survey or questions they want to ask. And I don't know why or how, but somewhere along the line, amongst the, at times, hundreds of questions, hundreds of variables that can be inserted in a study, somebody, for some reason or another, thought it would be interesting to ask people if they went to church or what the religion they are.
Mm-hmm.
Probably just for purposes of collecting background information on the sample. And
right.
In a lot of studies, in addition to whatever we're studying substantively, we ask generally just background questions, sociodemographic stuff, the age and income, and how many people live in your house, and how much schooling did you have. And I think for those reasons, decades ago, people just started asking people what religion they were, not with any sense that they were going to find anything of substantive interest.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, you know, all these studies that I kind of uncovered in the 80s, many of them, they weren't studies that were about religion and morbidity or religion and mortality. These were studies of every type of disease or outcome. And then you would look up in the tables reporting the statistical results in the paper, and maybe one line in the table mentioned religion, and in many cases the results weren't even discussed in the paper. The word religion didn't appear in the abstract of the journal article or appear in the title. It was just kind of buried in a table alongside of, you know, the hundreds of other questions.
Right.
And so this is why, as recently as 20 some years ago, most people in this field didn't even know that these studies existed. And people that would even do the studies and include questions on religion in their data collection hadn't realized that other people had done this. It really was until I began reviewing this work and a couple other people that this was even brought to anyone's attention. And what was so unusual is that we found there actually had been hundreds of these kinds of studies that were done. So it you know, I'm sometimes people have referred to me or to my colleague Harold Koenig at Duke or to the late David Larson, as other pioneers in this field, as fathers of the field of religion and health, or creators or inventors.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not true. This was not about creating or inventing. It was more about the discovering. So
right.
We were more discoverers than Thomas Edison's. All this work had been done. It's just nobody knew it was out there. It was just hidden away, buried in data tables and papers published all over the world.
When you talk about how this field has expanded over the last 20 years or so, 20, 30 years, and I was reading one of your papers, and you talk about three different areas of study that the field of religion and health has been broken up to. It's religion and health, spirituality and healing, and then recently a new, I guess, subdiscipline called theology and medicine has come to the fore. What are the differences between these fields of study?
Well, that's a great question, Tony. I mean, these are words that are bandied about and sometimes used interchangeably, and they really mean substantively quite different things. Religion and health is just kind of the word that's really been used all along to describe studies done by social and behavioral scientists and epidemiologists and some doctors in family practice and psychiatry who have looked at essentially the association or relationship between religious variables and health outcome variables. Usually surveys are done of general populations of people. Questions are asked about people's health, their mental health, and so on, or psychological factors. And questions are asked about people's their religious beliefs, practices, or religious identification, whatever, attitudes. And not to be technical, those two things are correlated. Mm-hmm. Statistical analyses are done. And this is really religion and health. Well, in the last, like you say, 20 years or so, there's been a real, I don't want to use this metaphor lightly, but really an explosion of interest in this topic, specifically within the complementary and alternative medicine field that's now known as integrative medicine, or CAM. So within that field, there's been tremendous interest, and tremendous interest in other clinical fields like nursing and allied health sciences, and also within the community of alternative medical practitioners. And so the interest there has not so much been about how religion impacts on epidemiological rates in the population. It's more been about healing. Mm-hmm. I mean, the interest has been, okay, so you've shown that these factors are associated with lower rates of this or that or less illness or whatever. Well and good, but, you know, we're practitioners. We're out there on the front lines treating people who are sick. Is there any evidence that any of this, the religious practice in the broadest sense, has anything to do with promoting healing, the healing of disease? That's really a different question.
Right.
And the simple answer is that there's much less evidence. Very, very few of these hundreds, thousands of studies that have been done by now have focused on healing. But that really hasn't stopped people from referring to this larger field as about healing. And it's kind of frustrating in a way. I think this is a very interesting question and a very valid topic for research to study the impact of religion on healing. It just hasn't been done to a very large extent. Mm-hmm. Now, parallel to this, there's also been really a growing interest in not just studying formal religious behavior, religious practices, religious beliefs, but focusing more on what's come to be called spirituality, a kind mm-hmm. of more, I don't know, subjective or qualitative sense of connection with God or the divine or the cosmos. And again, a very interesting topic. So there's really been, within kind of the alternative medical community, a great interest in wanting to investigate the relation between spirituality and healing. What's happened, though, is that sometimes, more than sometimes, a lot of the research on religion and health has been misinterpreted as providing evidence for a connection between spirituality and healing, and it's not. Mm-hmm. These studies of religion and health are studies of very discrete, observable religious behaviors. They don't tell us anything about some amorphous spirituality.
Right.
They're studies of, you know, the morbidity rates due to cancer at a certain site in a certain population. They don't tell us anything about the healing of disease. So it's one thing to say that people who attend church regularly have a lower rate of lung cancer morbidity in Utah. Mm-hmm. That's very different than saying, if you get sick, just pray or be religious or be spiritual or feel oneness with God, and your tumors will go away. This mm-hmm. is a very different topic, and I think the inferences really are not valid. But it's been frustrating because a lot of the research that I've been involved in and my colleagues on religion and health, religion epidemiology, has kind of been misinterpreted or overinterpreted as providing evidence of a healing power of spirituality.
I want to ask a little question on that. You mentioned that people who are alternative medicine practitioners have connected with this literature to some extent and have also been exploring different topics and such. I mean, has that created a tension within the field of religion and health that, you know, now that you start in the 80s and 90s start finding out that, you know, church attendance and as you say, very discrete, measurable practices have some effect on morbidity or mortality, and now you have alternative medicine people coming in, aha, this is a connection that we can do, you know, energy waves and things like that. Does that tarnish your field at all? Or
I don't think it tarnishes it. I mean, there's certainly some colleagues, how to put this, you know, further to the right, further to the mainstream than I am, that think very much it tarnishes. And there's been a lot of skeptical responses to the interest in healing and spirituality. Mm-hmm. I don't really share that perspective. I think the idea of studying the healing power of spirituality is fabulous. I'm all for it. My sense is it really hasn't been done to the extent that people think it's been done. But there certainly is a lot of tension. There are a lot of folks within the more mainstream religion and health field who are social scientists and not really biomedically trained at all and don't really have any interest in studying the healing power of anything. And, you know, for the most part, they've been indifferent to this growth of interest in healing. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there are also some people within the religion health field that are very traditionally religious, very conservative. There's a large contingent of very conservative Christian doctors mm-hmm. who are a little uneasy about the idea of studying, you know, energy healing or bioenergy healing or the healing power of positive intention or things like that, or even engaging the concept of spirituality, you know, however that might be interpreted. And I understand that completely. Mm-hmm. I understand that, and I appreciate it. Personally, I don't really share the same type of skepticism or the same type of concern. So my message is a little more discreet. It's simply that, you know, this is a great topic for research. I'm all for it. But please don't misinterpret what we've been doing all along as support for these ideas. Because I think ultimately it's kind of a dangerous message. So there have been, like I said, let's say about 3,000 of these religion and health studies that show that faith commitment to some extent seems to have a preventive effect for lots of reasons we mm-hmm. can discuss on health challenges. That's a very different thing than saying if you're sick, just be religious or be spiritual and you'll get better.
Right.
And I think we're really setting up some dangerous expectations for people about the healing process and about God and about religion and faith. It almost is turning faith in God into like the Easter Bunny or Santa Claus or something.
Yeah,
and then there's the other issue that if we don't get well, is because we don't have enough faith. And
right. Or if God doesn't exist or something.
Or whatever.
Right.
You know, I prayed the wrong way. It's you know, one of the things that the modern times in the West that we understand about health and illness and disease and etiology and all of that is that the ultimately the causes of health, the causes of the totality of our health and well-being, are multifactorial. That's kind of the word that we use in epidemiology. We know that our heredity has something to do with it, our genes. We know that the physical environment that we live in is important, the socioeconomic factors, mind-body factors, and, you know, stress, the way that we cope with things, our family environment. And so we also know now that what aspects of our religious beliefs or faith, this has something to say about it as well. It just deserves a place on the table with all the other factors that have something to say about our health. No more, no less. That's mm-hmm. the take-home point. But I think it gets translated into, and I've seen news stories written on this topic that, you know, scientists claim spirituality is the most important factor in health. Well, it's not. I mean, and
right.
you know, as an epidemiologist, I can tell you that cigarette smoking, control of infectious diseases, poverty, these are profoundly important factors.
Right.
You know, family history of disease, these are profoundly important factors.
Well, I think there's a tendency in the news media, and this is one of the things I wanted to talk about when we talked about the methodology of these studies, is that they will see a correlation or a statistically significant result in a study, and then they'll just run with that and give the impression that that's the only thing going on without recognizing that there's a dozen or two dozen more control factors that also have some degree of effect on the topic under study.
Well, right. I mean, it's kind of it's a soundbite approach to medical innovation. I mean, every Thursday, if the people who read the New York Times or USA Today or whatever, every Thursday, the used to be every Thursday, the press releases would come out from JAMA or New England Journal or wherever, and it would, you know, usually the latest interesting study would be featured, that this factor or that factor, you know, milk is good for your health or bad for your health, or
right.
salt or whatever, or exercise, or who knows what, or this gene. And so every Thursday there's a little featured story, and it's, and this is now the new thing. This is the main thing that's the cause of all our problems, or
mm-hmm.
this is the thing that's going to save us, and it gets hyped, and the blogs kick in, and the letters to the editor, and the rejoinders, and then the next week it's something else. And
right.
it's kind of a hit-and-run approach. And, you know, whenever these, there's a big religion and health study, it comes out, and your publicist gets you in the paper, there's like a little flap about it. And generally it's misinterpreted dramatically. So, I mean, it's put me in a funny position. I'm one of the, you know, I guess one of the pioneers of this field, that in some ways is partly responsible for all of this information being out there. And at the same time, the last few years, I've been a little more out there and a little more strident, saying, "Hold on,
right.
It's not what you think." And so it's kind of unusual. I've been, you know, I'm as much one of the popularizers as I am now one of the kind of naysayers.
Mm.
But the truth is somewhere in the middle. And I think the idea that religious faith, the religious commitment, whatever word you want to use, is potentially an important factor for the primary prevention of illness in populations, that it's a small but significant factor alongside of all the others, diet, nutrition, and exercise,
right.
and family history, and stress, and all the rest. I think that's a fabulous and very interesting, very exciting, very sexy piece of information, but it's not as provocative as the healing power of spirituality.
Right.
Just get sick and do these seven steps, and you know your disease will go away.
No, I reflect upon this because my folks back in the 70s, with all these studies coming out, you know, it would be like every Thursday, oh, we're rushing to the store to buy wheat germ or flaxseed oil, or you know, and as I learned more about statistics, I said, no, we got to set this all in broad context. And now you're recognizing that, and recognizing that you're not putting all your chips just on prayer or on, you know, church attendance or any one thing, that there are other factors going on. I want to delve into the specifics of your findings a little bit more. Now, recently you've written some stuff about people's perceptions of their connection with God and their general perceptions of their health. Tell us a little bit about that study that you did.
Well, I had gotten, this was actually back in the 90s, I had gotten a small grant from a research institute in California to do a study of people's relationship with God, the extent to which they felt that God loved them or they loved God. I had read a lot of work by the sociologist Pitram Sorokin, who was a very interesting figure in sociology, a Russian sociologist, passed away decades ago, who had written a lot about altruistic love. And as I read his works years ago, it struck me, this is interesting. I wonder if there would be a way to operationalize this. That's a fancy word we use to mean, you know, to come up with some measures of these ideas, and
right.
then collect some data in a clinical study and see if there was some relationship. So I developed an instrument. I developed some questions that asked people about the extent to which they felt that God loved them and that they had a loving connection with God.
What were some of those questions? I mean, how do you, this is an interesting question. I'm sure people in the audience are interested.
I don't have the index in front of me right now, but generally,
right.
you know, you come up with questions that try to. You know, God loves me.
And then,
I love God. God is love. Mm-hmm. Whatever you pilot it. You validate the questionnaire. You try to make sure that it's reliable and it's valid. That it's asking what you think it's asking, and that it's the answers are consistent. And then you insert it in a questionnaire along with all the other stuff that you ask people. How old are you? You know, is there a history of heart disease in your family? Whatever.
Right.
And so we then went into the field. I did the study in Virginia and collected data from a sample of primary care patients, family practice patients,
mm-hmm.
about 200-some people. And when I analyzed the results, it was very fascinating. I found that, first of all, people that had expressed a greater loving connection with God seem to rate their health as much better than people who had the people that didn't have that same type of connection.
Now that's a self.
There's some standard ways that epidemiologists ask people to rate their health, and we'll use those questions. And what's fascinating is that even when people quote unquote objectively were not in the best of health or were not in the best of functioning, they would perceive themselves as being better. And this was correlated to the extent to which they felt that they were loved. Fascinating stuff. And we tried to explain it on the basis of all kinds of other factors. Was this because of the sense of mastery or self-efficacy that being loved by God gave people? Well, no. Was this the sense that being loved, having a loving relationship with God, gave people a sense that they were supported and nurtured? No. Was this just a general impact of religion? We know that religion correlates with health. With people that love God probably are more religious, so we controlled for that. No. So I mean, in the end, for those in the audience that are statistically oriented, about 10% of the variance in people's health, perceptions of health, was due to loving God. Needless to say, this is not the typical sort of thing that's published in the medical literature, but we published it, and then we did a follow-up paper. Instead of looking at perceptions of physical health, we actually had some information also on one of the well-known indices of depression, of depressed affect, and essentially found the same thing, that a loving relationship with God was not just an important factor for one's sense of one's overall health. It also seemed to be preventive for depressive symptoms. And this was just a little study. We never really followed it up in the little data set from Virginia. But this is provocative stuff, and it really for me was kind of a sea change. That by the time I had done this study, that these studies both came out earlier this decade, earlier in the 2000s. I was kind of getting a little burned out of just the normal religion and health stuff, and I thought that this stuff about love and positive pro-social emotions, this was a much more exciting frontier for me, and I've been really doing a lot of work in kind of that area ever since.
And now is that that's the topic of your most recent book that's coming out, Divine Love, is that correct?
Right. Divine Love just came out at the time of this interview. It came out about a month ago, and what was interesting about that project was really neat. It was not explicitly a health-related project. I've been doing so much research and writing and reading on the topic of connection between human beings and God, loving connection, that I got together with a colleague, Dr. Stephen Post from SUNY Stony Brook, and we put together an academic work getting some of the best theologians in the world in the various religious traditions to weigh in on this topic of divine love. What does it mean? What do the different traditions say? So really, for me, it was a change of pace. It was a work of kind of a moral theology meets comparative religion. So for an epidemiologist, I was going a little far afield, but it was a lot of fun. And we ended up with a really nice work published by Templeton Press that gives the perspective on this concept of divine love in Buddhism and Christianity and Judaism and Islam and Hinduism and traditional African faiths.
Well, let me ask.
It was really fun.
Let me ask a little bit more about that, because you mentioned you're doing this across faiths, and do you find any type of denominational effect that Buddhists are much more cognizant of their connection with God and therefore have higher perceptions of health and well-being, or is this just very similar across all denominations? It really just relates to how anybody, whatever religious endeavor they're in, feels their connection with God.
Well, we haven't, like I said, we haven't done any studies of divine love or unlimited love cross-religiously yet. That just hasn't happened yet. We've just done this theological work. And certainly Buddhists aren't explicitly theistic. So to answer your question, Buddhists in many cases wouldn't even acknowledge God in the same way that we would as Jews or Christians. But I can tell you that you go back to the larger epidemiologic literature, these studies that have been done over the last 100 years, what's really fascinating is a connection between things like religious identification or religious practice or worship attendance or however religion is defined in these different faith traditions, a positive again, I'll simplify, a positive correlation, so to speak, between health and illness and religion. We have found this across traditions. Mm-hmm. This finding has been observed in study after study in Christians, in Roman Catholics, in Protestants, in every denomination, in established sects like Latter-day Saints and Seventh-day Adventists, in Jews of all branches, Orthodox Jews and so on, in Muslims, in Buddhists, large number of studies in Hindus. There were actually a bunch of studies done on Parsis, on Zoroastrians in India. There have been studies done of Zulu warriors and Zen Buddhist priests. And the point is, over the decades, these studies indicating a salutary, salient impact on health of religious practice or faith seems to exist irrespective of what one's religion is.
That's fascinating.
And I think, to a large extent, this has been one of the things that has fueled this research, and some quarters being somewhat controversial and somewhat a contentious topic. So not just the people that are antithetical to the faith are a little nervous about this literature, but the people who are very partisan are challenged by it as well. And so that's kind of the irony. If there is a religious factor in health, it does not seem to be a respecter of religion. This is very fascinating, and I find this as curious and as fascinating as anybody else. And so, really, certainly a frontier would be to try to isolate what it is about the practice of religion that is salutary. The example that I like to give. We've done studies let's say we got a big grant from the NIH to study the impact of eating food on mortality rates. So this is kind of fanciful, and we were going to study 10,000 people who ate food and 10,000 people who never ate any food, and follow them for 5 years.
Right.
Well, I guarantee you, the people that ate food would have a lower mortality rate over 5 years than the people who never ate food.
Right.
I mean, that's kind of silly. But that would tell us nothing about what they ate, when they ate, how much they ate, mm-hmm. Where the food came from, and so on. And in many ways, the religion and health field is kind of still in that phase. We know that having some type of a commitment, some type of a practice, seems to exert a positive impact on health. But what that is, and when it is, and why, and under what circumstances, that's what we need to focus on. And that can help us understand what the active ingredients are, so to speak.
Right.
The same way that we know in food that we know about vitamins and nourishment. So to me, it's like we've done a lot of answering the what question, the what, the who, the where, the when. Mm-hmm. But we really need to focus more on the how and the why.
Yeah, that was one of the things I wanted to press you on, because a lot of epidemiology studies tend to be focused on correlational issues, that we measure either 200 people, or we get a big study of 10,000 people, we see a lot of people eat apples, they have a lower rate of prostate cancer, and then the two are connected in one another, without necessarily knowing the cause, as you mentioned before, what sociologists would call causal linkages between these, what kind of affects this kind of thing. One of the things that let me play devil's advocate here for a second. And we see, let's say, church attendance leads to lower blood pressure, or church attendance leads to lower rates of cancer and stuff. Is it really the religious factors, the church attendance, or the belief in God, or the praying, that is a factor here? Or are there other spurious relationships that need to be sorted out here? And how does the field sort those out?
Well, I'd say they aren't. The connections are not spurious, but what we need to understand, we observe a connection between two variables.
Let's say
it's church attendance or whatever, religious attendance and health. The question to answer, and as a social scientist would phrase it, what are the mediating factors? What are the factors that are engendered by the variable of interest that are caused by, you could say, that themselves impact on health?
Mm-hmm.
And so, over the years, all kinds of possibilities have been proposed. In my book, God, Faith, and Health, I sum these up. So, for example, I look at it this way. The question I ask is What are the manifestations or the expressions or the outcomes of religion? What are the functions of religion or spirituality or faith that are or should be correlated with health? And there are many. So we know that, for example, religion can, in the broadest sense, religion can shape our behavior, can mm-hmm. encourage us to behave in a certain way, avoiding smoking, avoiding drinking and drugs, and taking right. care of ourselves. Religious messages can impact on healthy lifestyle behaviors. It doesn't always work that way,
right.
of course, but that's certainly something that faith can do for many of us. It can inspire us to behave properly. And we certainly know that our behavior, our healthy behaviors, are associated with better health. Another thing that religion can do, especially if we're actively involved in a congregation or a religion, is it can provide what the social scientists call social support. It mm-hmm. can provide the quality and quantity of supportive relationships with other people. But this can be very tangible support, like advice or a ride to the doctor or whatever, but also be emotional support. It can provide us friendships and that can help us cope with the stress of life. Mm-hmm. And we know, again, independently of religion, we know that social support is a very important factor for health. What's another thing that religion can do? It can, the worship services can be a source of really soothing, calming, wonderful, inspiring, uplifting emotions or affects, as we say. And we know that our feelings, our emotions, our affects can also impact on our health.
Stop you right there. There's you know, I casually read some of this literature, but it seems that a growing interest in the mind-body connection has been
certainly
pervasive in the literature recently. And the idea that, you know, if you have a more optimistic attitude or you deal with crises better without, you know, breaking down as quickly, you tend to heal faster. Is that what we're finding?
Certainly. I mean, within psychology, dating back, I'm going to say almost 40 years, mm-hmm. in a field known as psychoneuroimmunology, which people look at neuroendocrine impacts on health. Essentially, the connections between the human nervous system and the immune and endocrine system, and there have been efforts to map out how our emotions, how our cognitions, our attitudes, and so on, impact on not just on states of health or perceptions of health, but also the healing process.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating stuff. This is a mainstream of psychology. I don't know that it is. There was a time it certainly was not. It's becoming more mainstream. But I mean, I think the take-home point on this is that religion, in the broadest sense, whether we're talking religious beliefs or practices or faith or spirituality or whatever, that whole big gamish, that whole big field or nexus or domain of life known as religion, if it can influence our behavior, influence our social relationships, influence our emotions, influence our cognitions, our attitudes, our beliefs, our experiences, then this is a way to help make sense of its connection with health. So here we've observed all these thousands of studies showing this connection between religion and health, and you know, we scratch our head and go, well, gosh, that's goofy. Does this even make sense? Is there mm-hmm. a way to understand it? Yes, there is. There's a very naturalistic way to understand these findings. It's because of the behavioral and psychosocial and psychological, emotional, cognitive, and so on. It's because of these functions of religion. Mm-hmm. And we know that these things, and the human psychology and sociology and behavior and so on, these things impact on health. And this is mainstream thinking. This isn't woo-woo stuff. And so I think it's very important for the next wave of people studying this topic, whether epidemiologists or sociologists or doctors or whomever, nurses, to really begin focusing on what it is about the practice of religion that mm-hmm. impacts health, and teasing out these behavioral and psychosocial factors. You know, I'm going to be bold here and say we don't need another 30 years and another 3,000 studies of, you know, correlating do you go to church or not with, you know, kidney disease or something. You know, we've done this. We've done the what. We've done the what to death. It's time to really focus on the how and why. And I think if we do that, this information will maybe have an easier pathway into into being accepted and adopted and understood by the biomedical community, because it will be interpreted and made sense of in acceptable terms.
Right.
And the more that it's just posited as some sort of strange mystery, and we don't attend to the causative factors, I think it will remain marginal and deservedly so.
Right. I'm just kind of asking, and you're leading me right to, you know, where I wanted to go here. We have a few minutes left in the podcast here, and you're talking about the frontiers of the field and where it should be going, really kind of focusing on that why question. One methodological question that I want to throw in here: a lot of these studies have been done, survey instrumentation and correlational studies. Has there been any work dealing with this experimentally? That one of the ways that scientists try to tease out the causal linkages is, you know, control through experimental designs. And, you know, is that something that the field is picking up on now? Are there any ethical questions involved in that kind of study?
Well, yes and no. I mean, in epidemiology, we don't do experiments because we're looking at characteristics of populations to
right.
see how they're associated with other characteristics of populations, like
that's true.
Health. And you cannot experimentally assign somebody's religion to them. It doesn't make any sense.
Right.
But there has been a little subset of this larger religion and health field in which experiments have been done, and they're exceptionally controversial, dating back probably to the 80s, maybe before. There have been no one really knows. I'll say about 200 published analyses of the impact of prayer. On disease and sick people. These have been double-blinded, randomized controlled clinical trials, what are
mm-hmm.
called RCTs, randomized controlled trials, of absent prayer or distant prayer on human beings, on animals, on all kinds of different biological systems.
And so you've got
two groups of people, say, with heart disease. You randomize them, and one group is being prayed for at a distance by
okay.
people that they've never met.
Mm-hmm.
These studies have been done. The most famous was published, the result was published in 1988. It found that a group of heart disease patients in San Francisco who were prayed for, this is completely double-blinded. The patients didn't know they were being prayed for. The doctors and nurses didn't know who was in what group. The people doing the praying didn't know. All they had was a picture of the person and their first name.
Mm-hmm.
That those people had better outcomes. They had a shorter hospital stay. They needed less intubation, less antibiotics. Well, this raised a you-know-what storm when it was
right.
published, and it was exceptionally controversial. It was as randomized control trials go, it was a very methodologically sound, acceptable, effective trial. It was essentially a drug trial. It's a pharmaceutical trial of distant prayer. And since that time, there have been a number of other studies done. And some of them have found results, and some haven't found results. And
mm-hmm.
some have not just been done in people. They've been done on animals or on agricultural plots, you know, praying for this plot of corn or mung bean sprouts or whatever, and not this one, and the ones that were prayed for grew faster. And,
mm-hmm.
and so, you know, needless to say, this has been extremely controversial. And I think for those of us who do the epidemiologic research, some of us find it very interesting, but it's a little frustrating that the work we do is confounded with this other work.
Right.
I've been asked for years and years to tell, you know, people have asked me about my research on the healing power of prayer or whatever, and I have to say I've never done any of those studies.
Right.
I have nothing against them. I just have other fish to fry.
Right.
But there have also been, compared to the thousands of studies on religion and health, there have been relatively few. And the discourse on the topic has been, at least as a scientist, it's been a little disturbing. You have, on the one hand, people are claiming, we've done all these studies, and we've now proven the healing effects of prayer at a distance. Well, actually, there have been some, a gentleman named Dr. Daniel Benor, a friend of mine,
mm-hmm.
a psychiatrist, did an analysis, a review of all of these studies a number of years ago, and found that about three-quarters of them, methodologically, were just severely flawed. And only about a quarter of the studies were really well done. Now, of those, about a half to two-thirds found something.
Mm-hmm.
statistically significant. So the flip side, there's people say, oh, none of these studies are any good. They haven't found anything. They're all garbage. Right. There was a famous study done at Harvard a few years ago that didn't find anything. And so a lot of the response was, well, the case is closed. There's nothing here.
Right.
Well, that wasn't true either. So that, like a lot of things, the truth was somewhere in between.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people use these studies as a way to either prove or disprove some sort of religious tenet, either, you know, God always answers everybody's prayers and now science has proven it, or, you know, there's no such thing as God or a higher power and now we've disproven it. Well, my feeling is that naturalistic science, the science of observation and physical reality, cannot prove or disprove anything that ultimately is supernatural. And if we're trying to come up with studies to draw inferences about the existence or the impact of God or the divine, we're wasting our time. It's doomed from the start.
Right.
You know, greater minds than yours and mine, great theologians and philosophers for thousands of years have mused about the existence of God or a higher power and the idea that somebody's going to do a double-blinded trial at Harvard or Hopkins or something, and once and for all, prove or disprove this. I can't say this strongly enough. I think is insane.
Right. No, that's absolutely true. I mean, I think the work that you're doing is this. You know, people need to keep that in its proper context. That this is not, you know, a proof of the deity or not.
No.
But it's you know, this is real life. That people do go to church and we do see these results, and it's an important factors that we need to keep in mind when we talk about not only, you know, health impacts but general sociological trends and policies toward religion and things like that. So.
That's right. There are very, like, again, naturalistic, very normal, biomedically sound ways to understand why the practice of religion can impact on health. We don't need to resort to mysterious or supernatural explanations, while at the same time we don't rule those out. I myself, I'm a believer. I'm Jewish. I'm religious. I believe in a God that answers prayers. I pray to God at synagogue, at home. I think it's wonderful. I'm all for it, but this is a very different issue than showing the value for our health or our mental well-being of having an active faith commitment.
And I think that's a really good lesson to close on here for our podcast. Our podcast is Research on Religion, and our goal here in this entire series is to highlight the scientific and social scientific study of religion with a recognition that, you know, taking religion seriously by people who practice religion and such like that. So, Jeff, I want to thank you for being on the podcast today. We'll probably have you back again to talk about some of the other results that you find. And Jeff, thank you again.
Thank you, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.